Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of SF Crossing the Gulf. I'm Karen Burnham.
And I'm Karen Lord.
And today we are going to continue our discussion of some of Greg Egan's short fiction. We left off, well, last episode we discussed Rainmaker's Mistake, but the episode before that, we left off seeming like we were going to launch into a discussion on Glory, but instead I was thinking we might start this podcast off by talking about The Plank Dive.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, now The Plank Dive is set in the same universe as his novel Diaspora, which is probably my favorite Greg Egan novel. Everyone involved is post-human. They're all, you know, various types of computer programs. And let's see. One community of these post-humans has decided to send copies of themselves inside the event horizon of a black hole. This is not, properly speaking, a suicide mission. There are things that they hope to understand on the inside of that event horizon, even though they know they won't be able to communicate it back to their originals. They still think the exercise would be worthwhile on its own. And while they're preparing for this mission, which they call the Plank Dive, a father and daughter come from a community that's based closer to Earth and a community that's really focused on preserving and progressing the arts of embodied humans, of us. Classical literature, Shakespeare, classic references, Homer, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The daughter of the pair is a top-notch scientific mind who has been stultified in her upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
And the father is just he's a straw man, I think.
He is completely.
He is over the top. He says, I am going to write the story of your plank dive, and don't bother me with these trivial scientific details. I'm going to assign you all motivations. And
it's going to be an epic.
Right, I'm going to write your epic. And the scientists just sort of look at him like he's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
One of the scientists takes a great interest in the daughter and making sure that she had, you know, that she can express herself. In the end, the father goes away in a huff and seems to take his daughter with him. And then it turns out that there's a copy of the daughter in the complement of the crew who's headed into the black hole.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, you actually get both the perspective of the folks who stayed behind and the perspective of the folks who do the dive.
Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing as well that I noticed was that the journey from Athens, from the place that sort of was focused on art, was such that the time it took to get, the time it would take to return, was it about 200 years would pass or so?
Mm-hmm.
So the daughter, who is all scientifically focused, is also gambling that society will have changed by the time she gets back.
Right.
I thought that bit was interesting.
Yeah, taking advantage of the relativistic travel times.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No, say, I have to admit that my initial response to this story was, you know, yeah, this is a bit heavy-handed. But we had an interesting pre-podcast discussion, which we're now going to lay before you, where I was given some insight into the context for this.
Okay, so what you have to realize is that this would have been written in the mid to late 1990s, and at that time, there was these academic wars raging between the humanities departments and the science departments. Deconstruction and postmodernism were the thing, especially in literature departments.
Mm-hmm.
And these ideas were starting to spread and were being spread seemingly aggressively by some of the professors involved. And a lot of what they were saying is what they seemed to be saying. I understand this is not the actual position of postmodernism, but what they seemed to be saying was, everything is relative. There is no such thing as absolute truth. Even 2 + 2 = 4 is a statement that can be interpreted and is, you know, no more right than to say 2 + 2 = 5, depending on your context. It was very political. The scientific community felt very much under attack at the time. I remember I was working in the late 90s as I was studying physics, but I was working my way through college as the web designer for a women's studies department. So I found myself in this very uncomfortable situation where the people in the women's studies department were attacking me for studying physics. They said, why?
Well, was that the patriarchy thing?
Yeah, yeah. They literally said, why are you selling out to the patriarchy? And I said, wait, I'm a woman in science. Aren't you supposed to be supporting me?
Oh, my word. Yeah.
And basically, in a lot of his work around this time, Greg Egan took a very strong and I think I say in my book, when Egan is at his most satirical, he is at his least subtle. And yes. He goes, whenever he's really got his dander up about something, he goes so over the top. I usually think it's hilarious. A lot of, like you say, it is heavy-handed. I mean, what he's saying is that people who care only about art without understanding science are lacking something just as much as people who understand science without art.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And sorry, go ahead.
Well, the one other thing I wanted to say was that he sets himself a very high bar, and it can be debated whether or not he passes it, both in this story and in almost all the fiction he writes that follows, mm-hmm. where once you leave the original community and you go with the crew that does the plank dive, mm-hmm. He tries to convey the same sense of drama and urgency and passion mm-hmm. without in any way dumbing down the science that yes. he's got these people passionate about. Mm-hmm. And it's mm-hmm. the same thing you're going to see from Schild's Ladder. It's the same thing you're going to see from Incandescence. It's the same thing you're going to see from the Orthogonal Trilogy, moving forward in time. And to the extent that he is or is not successful in that project is almost a career defining statement, you know, mm-hmm. that he believes that that art can function this way in tandem with science, and all the people who don't think so, who find this sort of gobbledygook to be boring, he has absolutely no use for them.
that's a very good point that you're making there. I was going to say that What I find particularly interesting about Egan's work, and one of the things that perhaps we didn't stress when we were talking about it in the first podcast on his work, is that there is always going to be the reader who is the scientist that can fully understand what he is talking about. And they are going to get a level of thrill, enjoyment, what have you, that the non-scientist reader is going to completely miss. But in a way, that's a pity, because what some other stories, what some of Chang's stories, for example, manage to do is he will give you something on different levels, so that even if you're not going to be able to grasp the science and get your thrills there, he's going to give you some other little tidbit, something to appreciate that will keep you in the story. Egan is very much focused on. He's actually an evangelist of science in a way.
He is. No, very strongly. Very strongly.
Yes. And I do think that to discuss his stories without talking about some of the detail of the scientific theories that he's using and how well he integrates them into his story, to not do that is in fact to do him a disservice. So I am warning you that for this podcast, I expect you to be able to talk a bit more about that, even if you're just, you know, pointing readers to.
So are you saying there will be a quiz?
Don't you dare. Oh man. Not for me, but if anyone else wants there to be a quiz, I do understand that he has all these things worked out, formulae and everything, on his website. He has yes. he has all the information if you want to seek it out.
Absolutely. No, it's stunning the amount of work he's done on his website. I mean, the guy only has, well, quote unquote, only has a bachelor's degree in math. That's it. That's all he has. Bachelor's degree in math. He has done PhD level work. He's got 80,000 words about the orthogonal universe on his website. Mm-hmm, I mean, he's mm-hmm. written a whole nother book that's basically a PhD dissertation on the physics of an alternate universe.
Yes, yes. And I think this is very important. I appreciate that it's not going to be as accessible to a larger group of people. But I still think it's a very important thing to do. Now, the other thing I was going to say is that the context for the story, to me, is hugely important, because the same way you can't read, say, Jonathan Swift, especially some of his more heavily satirical works, you can't read those and understand or appreciate them without understanding exactly what he's satirizing. So for someone to just come and read The Plank Dive and not notice when it was published and not be aware of what the situation that led to it is all about, you are going to have a very, well, you're going to have a trivialized view of it. You're not going to give it its full credit.
Yeah, and I feel a little bad. There's been a I don't want to call it a spat. That would be too much. There's been a dialectic, maybe. Anyway, Adam Roberts, British SF writer and critic, who is, I believe, a scholar of 19th century literature as his day job. He wrote a review of Egan's, I believe it was Incandescence. Egan, it's the only review Egan has ever publicly responded to. He was so pissed off about it. And if you were to read The Plank Dive and think, oh, he's talking about people like Adam Roberts, that would be wrong. That would not be right at all. And it would be insulting to, it would misunderstand the story, and it would be very, very insulting to Adam. And you have to understand that debate didn't happen until, say, 2008. And this story was written in the 90s. So, you know, I hope no one would think that Egan was talking about specific people in the science fiction community. He was really talking about a specific movement within academia.
And I have to say, I too encountered the edges of that movement when I was reading papers from that era, later in my work later on. And it really did get a bit extreme. As you said, I think that there's kind of moderate postmodernism, that has a lot of merit for the particular areas and subjects where it's applied. But there were people on the fringes, if you want to call it that, who were determined to push this thing to the max. So I was reading, for example, systematic theology, and coming across some heavily postmodern approaches that frankly made no sense whatsoever if you were a historian. And theology, of course, has a strong element of history to it. So when I read that, and I can think of how frustrated I was reading this and thinking, but they come from reputable institutions and universities, and they're professors, and they have qualifications. How is this possible?
Yeah,
but and this is what happened.
Well, and at this point, it might be worth bringing up the Sokol hoax, where there was a physicist named Alan Sokol, and he wrote this paper full of gibberish and gobbledygook, and he titled it something along the lines of "On the Hermeneutics of Quantum Mechanics," and he sent it to the leading postmodern literary journal that were doing an interdisciplinary issue. And they published it, and they were so proud of themselves for publishing this groundbreaking interdisciplinary work. And the day it hit the publication stands, Sokol basically broadcast to every media outlet he could find what idiots these people were for accepting a work that had absolutely no intellectual heft or bearing or grounding in anything, realistic in any way, shape, or form. And the academic flame wars.
Yes, and to tell the truth, there was a point where it almost felt like performance art.
There were so many useful insights to be had from what some of the intellectual products were. I mean, science happens in a culture, and it matters who does the science. It matters if there are no women doing it. It matters if there are no people of color doing it, because a lot of science is what questions do you ask?
Exactly. And what do you expect to find?
And what do you expect to find?
We don't realize the extent to which scientists are influenced by what they expect to find, because that's what will prompt their questions in the first place.
Exactly.
I hope I mentioned this before. My background, of course, in history of science and technology is what makes me appreciate this. When you look at science as it is carried out by different eras, shall we say, or different groups, that fact of relativism, in a sense, does smack you in the face, but not to the extent of extreme postmodernism.
Right, not to the extent where you have to sit there and go, oh my God, 2 + 2 might not equal 4 because I'm Jewish. You know, that's just, no, that's ridiculous.
Yes.
You know, it's a shame because I feel like if the conversation had happened a little more gradually and if people had brought scientists into it a little more, that some of the lessons that science needed to learn might have been learned a little faster.
Yes, good point. Yes.
Whereas, especially in the late 1990s, the science departments were feeling kind of under attack, and they were frankly kind of hunkering down and going, well, fine, well, we don't want any of your insights then.
If they're going to be like that, yes.
Right. You know.
So we take all this into context, and suddenly Prospero doesn't seem like such a straw man anymore because we have seen people like that writing papers.
Exactly.
Yes.
And I do also have to say, Prospero is understated compared to two of the academics who are portrayed in Egan's 1990s book Terranesia,
mm-hmm.
where oh my god. It's hilarious. It's one of my favorite bits of Terranesia is when he has this one character describing their doctoral work in a Canadian university. One of them's majoring in X-Files studies and
ouch.
Yeah.
Whee! Okay then.
So,
oh, man. Yeah.
But again, I mean, when you think about the project that Planck Dive lays out and how it pertains to the rest of Greg Egan's career, I mean, it's really striking to me. Actually, it almost marks a line in the sand that he has since challenged everyone else to cross or not.
Yes, yes. But it also, to me, highlights a pet peeve of his. And the pet peeve is the one that I find a little... No, worrisome is far too strong a term. I fear that it restricts his ability to tell a story in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And let me explain what I mean by that. He very much portrays art as a religion in The Planck Dive. And then there are later stories in Oceanic and in Oracle where he challenges the concept of operating on faith, operating on a non-facts-based system.
Mm-hmm.
That system is extreme art or extreme postmodern art or religion for that matter. And as you said, I begin to feel as if it's the same situation you just described, where there were lessons to be learned by the scientific community from postmodernism, but because it was pushed at them in such an extreme fashion, they shut down completely. So sometimes I'm reading some of Egan's other works, I'm thinking to myself, you've really drawn a line in the sand here. And it becomes very much a black and white issue as opposed to something more nuanced.
Yeah, yeah.
And that does become a bit worrying to me. And I think that's where the characters begin to turn into straw men, where the leaps in logic. I see leaps in logic in the soft sciences when he's portraying aspects of psychology and sociology. My suspension of disbelief fails. Because I think to myself, wait, you're saying that this is so and therefore that is a consequence, but I don't see that. And then there's this gulf in between. And I think to myself, well, if I'm considering it from your point of view, I see how you made that leap. But in the sense of both real world sense as well as narrative sense, it's more of a stretch.
Mm-hmm.
And I distinguish between real world sense and narrative sense because... In narrative sense, you're accustomed to making leaps.
Right.
You make leaps for the sake of the story. In this, you also have to be aware that internal logic for your universe can't be sacrificed. If you're going to make that leap, it can't contradict other aspects of what you have going on in your story, because that's where the real suspension falls through.
Okay.
You want me to give you an example now, right?
That would be where it's leading, yeah.
Well.
should this be where we talk about Glory? Because I know you had that issue with Glory.
Glory, yes. Well, the main thing about Glory, I actually had to ask you if I'd read it right. We have a situation with mathematicians who have come to another culture to carry out basically excavations to discover the work of a more ancient civilization that was based on that planet. And that civilization was, well, they basically took mathematics to the pinnacle. To the extent where they called it, what did they call it? The Big Crunch?
The Big Crunch, where a whole vast number of different branches of mathematics would finally be understood as a unity.
Right. And that is a story, that is a concept I thought was fantastic. But then somewhere along the line, the premise was put forward that the reason that this civilization no longer existed was that having solved everything worth solving, they stagnated and dwindled away.
Right.
So the sort of the punchline of the story was that when the discovery that they were looking for was made, they decided to hide it in order to preserve their own society, in order to let their own society continue on for a bit longer. Specifically because there was, now let me get this straight, there was a type of society they called spreaders, and these were the ones who were very much more into space travel and exploration and colonizing other worlds and so forth. And then there were the ones they called, is it the seekers?
Mm-hmm.
Who tended to be, those are the ones who would take mathematics to its natural conclusion and very much focus on discovering truth and so forth. So the idea was that spreaders will eventually overrun seekers if the seekers get to the point where they've solved too much and they start to stagnate. So the idea was that they had this spreader civilization that they felt they would have to push back against, so they hid the knowledge so that their own society would not be tempted to dwindle into this stagnation and complacency, what have you, and fail to fight back.
Wow, okay. When you're saying that, I can absolutely see everything you're saying in the context of that one story, but since I see Glory as part of a continuum of his far future books, I don't read it that way at all.
You have the full context. Give me some context.
Okay, so the Amalgam is it's basically galaxy spanning, and everyone's post-human or post-alien or whatever. Lots of people were originally human. Other people, citizens, were originally other aliens, and everyone's kind of worked out their communication protocols. And there's also a bit in Glory. So one of the important things is that two scientists mathematicians have come from the Amalgam to a very Earth-like planet. Basically, our level of technology, our kind of Cold War-ish nation-state politics, right? Our level mm-hmm. of violence.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, they come and there's no prime directive, there's no Star Trek subterfuge, oh, we're going to pretend we're not here. No, they come in and say, hi, we're from another planet, and we'd like to help you with your archaeology. And of course, one presents to one major side of kind of a Cold War standoff, and one introduces themselves to the other side so that everyone will feel nice and evil and even and balanced, right?
Yes.
And our viewpoint character at one point is asked, well, you know, is it all galaxy-spanning wars out there? And she says, no, look, this kind of violence is a stage. You know, you get past it. There's a point at which that's ridiculous in terms of just the logistics of spreading out into the galaxy. You guys look at your phase of history and think that's all there is, and that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
So other parts of the Amalgam, I feel, have of the Amalgam stories, and then that section of Glory, I think, kind of reject the whole seeker-spreaders dynamic altogether.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't read that as being... Basically, I read that as something that the Earth-like culture had proposed that Joan and Anne kind of poo-pooed.
Uh-huh.
But you're right. You're absolutely right that at the end of the story, Anne discovers these theorems that the ancient alien civilization that had existed on this planet before the current civilization and she tries to convey this information to Joan, our viewpoint alien, while she's being hunted by a bunch of fighter jets, or what have you, the equivalent. Mm-hmm. And Joan misses most of the presentation, as it were. And mm-hmm. then, okay, and here's one of the beautiful things about Glory. Glory starts with three pages of the most amazing, almost amazingly beautifully pointless description of how to convey a post-human from point A to point B that you will ever read. Mm-hmm. It is stunningly, it hits your sense of wonder on just all levels, at least mine. Of stellar dynamics and propagating and using the quantum Zeno effect and propagating information through a star and making it your own little chemical factory to deposit this little tiny seed on a moon. Oh my God. Okay, so it's uh-huh. a brilliant bit of stellar engineering, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the story, Joan has missed most of Anne's attempt to present this information, and now the physical base of the information, the tablets it was written on, have been destroyed.
Yes.
And Joan thinks up a similar feat of amazing stellar engineering
mm-hmm.
and says, I could recover this information if I act right now. And then she says, you know what? No, I'm going to let it ride. And it's no, it to me, I read it as it's cheating to just take a shortcut to the end. That in the process, the intellectual inquiry of science,
mm-hmm.
just jumping ahead to the end feels like cheating. The journey is as important as the destination, and that's borne out by several other of Egan's amalgam stories.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
And what if I were to rename the Spreader and the Seeker as Dionysian and Apollonian?
That still loses me a bit, I'm afraid.
Well, Egan presents, so you know the Dionysian-Apollonian dichotomy?
Well, I know the names, but I don't think I know enough of the background to get a full grasp of where you're coming from.
Okay, so Dionysian is very exuberant, it's very excessive, it's very visceral, it's
mm-hmm.
it's a society that revolves around, and again, this is over-the-top descriptions, but it's hedonistic, it's sensual, it's mm-hmm. your rave party culture, right?
mm-hmm.
Apollonian is, a lot of people describe it as having the same level of passion, but all turned inward to
very cerebral.
Yeah, very cerebral, very intensely intellectual pursuits. Egan is Apollonian. All his mm-hmm. fiction is.
Mm-hmm.
He almost entirely rejects, or just doesn't even address, physical sensual pleasures. It's one of the reasons why post-humanity, you know, disembodied futures fit so easily in his fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I see their culture, especially the amalgam, as being intensely Apollonian, at which point, why deny yourself the pleasure of the seeking of the journey?
I see.
Wow, so I think you're saying to rewrite my book now.
Then this has been a useful exercise.
Except that it's due in October.
Oh, you know, footnotes. Footnotes are great. Well, I guess I can see where you're coming from. I suppose the bit that impacted more on my memory was this concept of, oh, you know, it's also going to give us sort of motivation to still be a vibrant society when those spreaders come into our vicinity.
Yeah, see, my take is that the whole spreaders thing is, like, I don't even pay attention to it because
right.
the amalgam has solved that problem. It's okay. been demonstrated in other stories that that's just so not an issue.
Now, you see, this is another example of context because since the short stories are themselves cited within a universe that has been explained in other short stories and in novels, you really do miss a lot if you don't have that background as well.
Yeah, I'd never even thought about that because, it seems to stand on its own, but now that I'm
different interpretations come
yeah,
out,
now
yeah.
that I'm hearing your reading of it, I'm like, no, within the context of that story, I think you're absolutely right that he doesn't, you know, unless you're familiar with the rest of the amalgam, you're gonna not read it the way I did.
This is fascinating. Okay,
By the way,
okay.
the amalgam is one of the only actually named scenarios in Egan's fiction where he does have a common setting in which several stories are told.
Okay.
Other times you can kind of make a connection. The Shield's Ladder story is like a little bit before the amalgams formed. You could kind of hand wave it, and Diaspora is kind of before that. But officially, amalgam's one of the only settings that he has that's actually common.
Well, it makes sense for him to have a pocket universe for everything to fit into, because in a way, everything is so much science-based.
Right.
That it's not as if you're going to have another place that's wildly different.
Well, except then he did the orthogonal universe, which is another place that's wildly different.
but you see, even that you could say is, well, we better say multiverse instead of universe then.
Right.
But yeah, okay, I see your point. Yes.
So Glory, it's, I have to admit, part of me just wanted you to love it, and I understand why you don't. But Glory has a special place in my heart because I think it's what made me a science fiction critic. It's certainly what made me an Egan scholar.
Mm-hmm.
Was when I read that and sort of put a bunch of pieces together and went, I see what he's doing there.
So it sounds as if Glory is best as not an appetizer, but in a sense as a dessert after having taken in some of the other stories and novels connected with this universe.
That's probably fair. And basically, I think Glory is a kind of capstone to the first decade of the 21st century for him.
Okay.
Especially taking Shield's Ladder and Incandescence together, and then Riding the Crocodile is a novelette or a novella that's set in the same universe.
Okay, that is actually a new title. I hadn't heard of that one.
Oh, Riding the Crocodile. It's it's only been collected. I don't remember where it was originally published.
Okay.
But it's another lovely, well, I think lovely story. Anyway, it's another amalgam story. And I think Glory is a beautiful capstone to that, but it doesn't really extend out to the orthogonal universe, which has been, this decade.
Okay. Well, okay, you have explained the background to Glory, and I'm very much willing to concede your point on that.
Well, no,
so
but
I'm going to give you another example, if I may.
Please do.
Let's look at Singleton.
Okay,
Singleton. And to a certain extent, Oracle.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. One thing that we should note is that Oracle came first, and Singleton is a prequel.
Right. Okay.
Which is, one of the only times Egan has done that. Also, Oracle is the only time, to my knowledge, that Egan has forayed into historical fiction.
Okay. Historical fiction? Would you classify that as historical?
Well, okay, so let's lay out that Oracle is basically a lightly fiction... I describe it as a intellectual cage match between a lightly fictionalized Alan Turing and a lightly fictionalized C.S. Lewis.
Well, I guess the reason why I hesitate to call it historical is that the footnote at the end, he's basically given, one, two references?
Yeah.
And when I think historical fiction, I think...
Intensely researched?
Yes.
Yeah, not so much.
At least more references than that. Because you have one or two references, and now I should point out, I'm not a Lewis scholar myself, but I've had occasion to butt up against both his fiction and his nonfiction. And the funny thing about Lewis, and I know that there are a good few writers who are not a fan of Lewis's work, nor his stance and so forth. But the funny thing about Lewis is that you have to be careful where in his life or his journey you encounter him.
Mm.
Because there are definitely, definitely writings of his that will make you pull your hair out and wonder what the man is thinking and want to smack him. But there are also later writings and works that you kind of go, oh, whoa, you changed. So I see sometimes a one reference or a two reference thing, and I think to myself, did you encounter something that was it can go either way. Either you can encounter somebody who's basically doing he was brilliant, this was fantastic, or you might encounter somebody who's, I'm gonna just like tear him down completely. So when he said there was this one reference, I was like, whenever I come across a reference that appears to be too much in one direction, I almost purposely go out and seek something that seems to be in the other direction.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, and sometimes this is more helpful, but sometimes time is not on your side, you try to find somebody who is as far away chronologically from the actual person. Historians sometimes are not very good at assessing people who are too close to their own contemporary era.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that again, both in terms of the positive and the negative. So you have some books that are written in gushing, glowing detail about someone who is barely remembered now as being seen. And then you have people who didn't even rate a biography, you know, within 50 years of their death. But by the time a historian comes along and sees what, you know, little work here, a little unpublished thing that was there, suddenly it blows up in significance.
You know, I was just reading something the other day that pointed out that, for instance, some Italian Renaissance artists that we think of as hugely dominant now were basically unknown. Their paintings were locked up in someone's attic for a couple hundred years and go, oh, well, that was just a nobody.
The art world is really vicious that way, isn't it? You've got starved to death after hacking off your ear. And then, you know, 100 years later, it's like your painting sells for like millions.
Right. The Getty Museum is bidding on it. And yeah.
It's cruel, I tell you. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm slightly off tangent, but that's why I challenge the term historical fiction. But I understand what you're saying there in the sense that he does have a Turing and a Lewis, and he's using them to make a point. So they're slightly straw man-ish.
Uh-huh. Well, and actually I went and read, because Egan referenced that particular book on Turing, I went and read it, and I think lightly fictionalized is generous. There's no way that the Turing of historical reality could ever be that with it or eloquent or socially aware as the Turing in Robert Stoney in that story.
And conversely, when I read about, you know, whatever you say about Lewis, he seems to have had friends and he seems to have been very well liked, which is at all what this particular character is like. This character in there, he's just sort of a blinker, dogmatic, sort of unpleasantly evangelical about his point of view in some respects.
Right. And I actually did consult a couple Lewis scholars about this story because as part of my research for the book, and they're like, okay, all the historical facts are basically correct, but wow, the arguments that Stoney tries to present to Lewis would never have worked. That's exactly the wrong way to try and persuade Lewis, you know, to abandon his point of view.
Mm-hmm. Well, good, because that brings me to my example. We just described
Oracle, but we should be talking about Singleton.
But Singleton as well it's based on the power of a meaningful single choice.
Mm-hmm.
So we have multiple universes theory, and I am actually going to hand over to you at this point so you can tie in what happens with both Oracle and Singleton that very much relies on this idea.
Okay, so some people worry about, you know, becoming post-human, and they worry about losing bodies or, you know, not being able to play football anymore or something like that. When Egan thinks about uploading our brains into computers, he's not at all worried about that. He's worried about the multiple worlds interpretation of quantum physics, which says that a quantum computer works by basically running every branch of a computation simultaneously. And so that every choice you make, every branch point of the universe, all paths are taken, and you mm-hmm. just find yourself in one branch of that whole infinite number of possible universes.
Yeah.
And in Singleton, he has one character who becomes obsessed, like so many science fictional, and particularly Egan narrators are, obsessed with this idea that for every time he makes the right choice, there are other versions of him that are making wrong choices. And that it's just all down to luck more than anything else. And so he develops a quantum computer that is shielded in such a way that when it makes a choice, that is the only choice that it makes. Mm-hmm. It never branches. Now, the world is still multiple worlds. And at this point, I should mention that multiple worlds interpretation is not the dominant interpretation of the quantum waveform collapse in quantum mechanics. Copenhagen is the dominant one, which more or less says that there's something else going on when something, there's a moment when the quantum waveform collapses. While it could previously have been A or B, we observe it, now it's only A or only B. Multiple mm-hmm. worlds says that we may see A, but another world sees B. Copenhagen mm-hmm. basically says, no, now it's only A, and there's something that happens that makes it be only A that time.
Okay.
So multiple worlds is not actually the dominant interpretation, but it is, there's nothing in quantum mechanics that rules it out,
mm-hmm.
which makes mm-hmm. it a whole ton of fun to play with, and science loves playing with it.
Yes.
Okay, so that's quantum multiple worlds, and I should strongly recommend, if anybody's really curious about quantum mechanics, a great intro book is How to Explain Physics to Your Dog. By Chad Orzel.
Sounds like I need to run out and buy that one.
Oh my god, it's so great. It's available as an ebook, and I loved it. I just read it a couple years ago. Actually, mm-hmm. I think I read it last year. It's also, Chad Orzel is Kate Nepfu's husband, and people may know Kate from her writing on Tor.com.
Cool.
And when I found out they were a couple, mm-hmm. I was like, oh my god, that's so perfect.
A new level of fangirling.
Yeah, seriously. I was like, now I'm a fan of both of them.
Excellent.
So anyway, it's very, very well written, and it works through these oddities very, very well. Okay, so in Singleton, this obsessive guy, and he pursues this project. His wife kind of tags along. Well, she's doing her own thing most of the time, but he designs this computer that is shielded against these quantum branchings. They make an AI out of it, and they actually make a child out of it. And the same way as Ted Chiang's Life Cycle of Softer Objects that we've talked about before, it's an AI that is raised as a child. So mm-hmm. it starts out very infantile, it can't really control its body, and then it matures very much like a human intellectual progression. At a certain point, that child rebels, runs away, gets...
And makes some bad choices.
Makes some very, very bad choices.
A little bit mildly, yeah.
And has to be rescued. And then, as she's recovering from that, she basically says, you know what, okay, I understand what I am now, and I think this is worthwhile. And I want to kind of spread this... what she said is, all of humanity has always operated under the illusion that our choices matter. And for me, it's actually true. And I want to make that not be an illusion for more people.
Right.
And then that sort of ties in, and the Helen from Singleton, who's the AI kid, is obviously the person giving Robert Stoney in Oracle all his... sort of, again, shortcuts, sneak peeks mm-hmm. into the future so that his 20th century won't develop the way our 20th century did.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you have beautifully outlined my exact problem with mm-hmm. the story. How do we go from, we operate under the illusion that our choices matter, to our choices will only matter if they're single choices?
Walk me through that. Not seeing it.
Okay. Basically, she's saying that her choices do matter. Correct?
Right.
And they matter because she's shielded from the quantum branching.
Right.
So what that's telling me is that the whole idea is based on the sense that if you are participating in this quantum branching, and there are other versions of you who are making all the possible choices in the world that could be made, then your own choice is in some sense meaningless because it's just one of a whole bunch of randoms that had to happen for the full play of randoms to be expressed.
Right, that it feels like instead of weighing the options and making an intelligent choice, you're just one roll of the dice.
Precisely. So I will in fact tie this back to an earlier story, Closer, where I had a problem, as I said, with the idea that when the couple became in a sense identical, then there was this decision of, well, we know each other, we know how we think, we know how to be, what we know who we are, each other. And now there's no challenge, there's no interest. And I said, well, you know, if they just like waited.
Yeah, just wait a year, you'll diverge again. And...
Exactly. So again, I'm thinking to myself, well, these multiple versions of you in this multiverse, the moment they do make another decision, they're not you anymore, are they?
Right.
Because it's almost like, again, like identical twins, you know, you start off identical and immediately you start having different experiences. And as a result of those experiences, making different choices that again lead to different experiences and on and on and on. And therefore, I didn't quite see it as there's one you and then there are these random choices that are made in effect meaningless because you're given the full range of what could have happened. I more looked at it as there are several versions, there are several yous. There are several yous that eventually are no longer you because they simply didn't make this, do the same path as you did.
Well, but you can see his point that there's got to be a cluster of you that's very close to the you are now.
Then who is the you that you are now? Basically, you're one of the randoms making a decision.
Right.
For the rest of the randoms.
Right. Well, and his point is he doesn't want to be one of the randoms making a decision. He wants to only be him no matter what scenario he's in.
Well, it's interesting because you could flip it and say, what right do you have to restrict the experience that those other randoms will have?
And you just nailed the plot of Quarantine.
Oh, shut up.
Okay, no, that's hilarious because in Quarantine, which was his first science fiction novel in 1992, he again plays with the idea of the quantum waveform collapse. And he plays with the interpretation. He admits this is like, he does not believe this interpretation is true. He just loved the fictional possibilities of it. He played with the idea that there's something unique about human consciousness that allows the waveform to collapse, but that in the rest of the universe, the waveforms don't collapse. All the potentials exist in a kind of simultaneous soup, and it's a much richer and more diverse experience and environment out there that that perceives the human ability to collapse the quantum waveform as a threat. And so they enclose us in this, like, space-time bubble. Uh-huh. And okay, he wrote that back in 1992.
This is hugely amusing. I'm serious. Okay, then I withdraw because by giving me again more context into this book, I can appreciate that he has seen the different challenges, the different options that one particular. Well, this is what I don't understand because this is what I mean by. This is what I mean by a challenge to my suspension of disbelief. Because for some reason, the particular batch of stories that we have reinforce a particular view that has led me to believe, no, as an author, this must be his view, because look, it's come up in all these different stories. But of course, I have a drop in the bucket, and you've actually sampled the entire bucket. And you're at me straight on these things, but it's quite unfortunate.
But you're right. In the context of any single story, all your readings make perfect sense. And I'm like, oh, wow, yeah, if I didn't know about X, Y, and Z, then...
Oh, my word. Yeah. Well, do you know what would have probably helped me just a tiny bit? I would have needed, in those stories, in all of those stories, for one of those protagonists... Not even two, just one of those protagonists to be a little less dogmatic, to be a little less certain.
Yeah. I what did you think about the interplay between, was it still a Martin? No, it was Ben in Singleton. Ben and Francine. Francine, by the way, was the wife.
Yes. I actually remember that one.
No, I was just explaining to the reader, listeners.
Oh, well, yeah.
Them.
There were a lot of stories, and I'm not ashamed to admit that I may have let a name or two slip my memory, so I needed it as much as the listeners did. I think I actually found that the best thing about Singleton for me was the interaction between them, and as characters, I thought that they worked very well. it sounds a bit ironic, considering what we've said before about Egan and characterization and so forth,
mm-hmm.
say that in this one it was the science that I was annoyed at and the characters really loved.
I do think the characterization worked particularly well in Singleton.
It really did. So,
and I have to admit, between, and again, Singleton's a very long story. I don't know if it's novelette or novella off the top of my head, but you know, it covers their whole lives from when they met in college, and they conceive a child, and she miscarries, and then they decide to have this AI baby. And I think I read Singleton in my third trimester of pregnancy, and because I know I read the most recent Greg Egan short stories I read while I was in the hospital the night before they induced labor. Because, by God, I was going to finish reading every Egan short story before Gavin was born. But the scene where the AI is about to be downloaded, and which is essentially the baby's about to be born.
Yes.
And they're going through the doubts, and should we put it off? Should we stop it? No, we have to let this happen. And I don't know if I'm ready. And and the way Francine was when the baby finally is animated, mm-hmm. Oh, I was in tears.
Yeah, I thought it was really well done. I did. And to me, this is what I'm finding almost frustrating about Egan, because they're not, even his weaknesses are not consistent. Just like I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, people say Egan's so bad at characterization. I'm like, oh, but what about this person?
Yes, it's a challenge. And it's a challenge because I've been trying to appreciate, or shall we say, get a grasp of what makes the short story. And I've heard people say, well, the short story, you have a big idea. And that is what you're focusing on. So I've taken that to mean that sometimes when you're doing a short story, you are purposely simplifying, shall we even say, oversimplifying certain things.
Right, right.
So there are things that you drop. There are things that you're going to say to people, you know what, you're with me for a very short time, so you're going to have to, you know, really just sort of overlook a couple of things here because we have to get to our destination fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I can appreciate that. But at the same time, there still seems to be a bit of a stumbling block for me. And the stumbling block comes at different points. So sometimes it's because it's a straw man. Sometimes it's because I don't fully believe the philosophy behind it. Then I hear from you, but in this other story, the philosophy is completely turned on its head. I'm like, oh, okay. So he did see that there was more than one way of viewing this particular philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you give me context with the other stories in the universe to give background to things. And I begin to realize that I can give him a lot more credit than I was previously giving him. But my word, you really practically have to read his entire corpus, don't you?
And maybe so. and the thing is, as I've been, you know, doing all this Egan work, and I've been keeping my eye out on reviews that people have written of his stories and his fiction. Mm-hmm. And so often they'll be down on something, and I'll some aspect of the story, and I'll be like, well, but yeah, but, you know, what about this other thing, and what about this other thing? And it's like, it's actually hard for me to remember a single story without the context.
He's not a standalone author. He simply isn't.
Yeah, I think he isn't. Now,
Chang is the perfect standalone author.
Right, right. Now, all of his stories are so different from each other. But
Egan, no.
The interesting thing is, I think he's evolved that way. I think you might remember from the last podcast, I named three stories that are absolutely critical that we're not discussing because they're not available online.
Right.
And they're all from earlier in his career, and it's Learning to Be Me, Axiomatic, and Reasons to Be Cheerful.
Yes.
And those, I believe, stand on their own a lot more neatly than the ones we've been talking about.
My goodness.
Although, apparently, I am not a good source for that idea.
But you know what this is starting to feel like for me? It's like when Don't laugh. But it's like when Deep Space Nine first started to air.
I'm trying not to laugh.
Good. Keep it that way. So previously you'd had your Next Generation, which is episodic, you know, mm-hmm. things wrap up in an episode. Maybe you have a two-parter, arc, but you know, you can go away and come back to it and you don't get lost. Deep Space Nine, completely different. So you've got to know what's going on. That was actually a time in my life where I was traveling a lot, went overseas to some studies, whatever. So even if I traveled somewhere and they were showing Deep Space Nine, it was pretty much a guarantee that they were showing a different season from the one I left.
Mm.
So I kind of just zoned out after a while. And I began to appreciate from that experience why there are people who simply cannot get the same level of enjoyment that you do out of certain, say, standalone episodes of Star Trek. Because you've got the whole universe in your head. You've got all the characters, you've got all the lifetimes and the various bits of history and who did what in which era and so forth. And any episode that then comes along is never truly standalone because it always references those things in a way that give you that extra little thrill. Because we love things that refer to themselves in a way. You're almost it's an in joke.
Yeah, it's a reward to an extra reward to the diehard fan.
So Egan's done this thing where you're getting an extra reward if you know more of his work, which is very clever in a commercial sense.
I don't think he's doing it on purpose.
He is. I don't think he is. I'm not accusing him of that, but I'm seeing how it happens. I'm seeing how it happens.
Yeah. And okay, so we should talk about Oceanic before we wrap up, and we should wrap up in the next 10-15 minutes at least. And here's a piece of context that you desperately need to know to understand Oceanic.
Let me hear it.
Part of Oceanic is where Martin and his brother Daniel are talking about God, and then Daniel sort of inducts Martin into this more serious religious experience.
Mm-hmm.
And Martin's maybe 10, and his brother's a teenager, and he's always looked up to his older brother, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
That's autobiographical. And Egan's mm-hmm. actually written an autobiographical essay. It's one of his only autobiographical essays. It's one of the only things that I actually know about his youth. And he had an older brother, and his older brother got into a particular Catholic cult. They'd been raised as kind of casual Anglicans. His brother became this more serious kind of Catholic, and they shared a room, and they were talking about it, and Greg was young, and his brother was like, oh yeah, if you accept Jesus Christ into your heart, and Egan actually was a diehard believer mm-hmm. through most of his high school.
Mm-hmm,
and he actually mm-hmm. talks about, you know, how good it felt to have that faith, how good it felt to have that belief with him, mm-hmm. you know, at all the time. And then he talks about just kind of wandering away from it when he was in college.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's now in his autobiographical essay, the end is a denouement. It's not as intense as the emotional journey that Martin goes on in Oceanic.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which I suspect is because Egan lives a much less dramatic life than a fictional character, and I hope that's true.
Darn it, we all do.
Yes, may we all live less dramatic lives. I think it's really important to understand that first bit actually comes from a core of real religious experience, which is important to credit him with, because since we all know Egan as a diehard, almost evangelical atheist,
mm-hmm.
it might otherwise seem, I don't know, maybe patronizing or condescending.
Right, yes. And it's good to have that context. I'm actually going to go out of my way not to address it directly.
Mm-hmm.
For the simple reason that this is another bit of my background, which is sociology of religion. And there are different types of experiences of religious ecstasy, of which the particular group that you described and a particular approach that you described is just one.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, I'm almost holding back from delving into more detailed explanation of this because it is going to trigger my nasty academic side. The one that wants to fling references at you and get really detailed, and we don't have enough time for that in 10 minutes.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough.
But also because I think that there's something very interesting I found within the narrative itself, which is quite separate from what his own personal experience would have been. And I want to stress separate from what his own personal experience would have been, because I'm not saying this has anything to do with him personally.
Right, right.
What I found fascinating was the religious experience aspect also mirrored the protagonist's experience with sex or love.
Right, right.
And what I mean to there's in addition to the overall arc, which is about his having this intense religious experience, which he then discovers has a chemical, biological foundation to it, that is in fact completely divorced as to whether or not the source of the feelings is factual or real or true. But in addition to that, there's a sort of a scene in the middle where he has his first sexual experience. And this is no ordinary sex. No, this is sci-fi sex, which means that, let me see if I get it straight. The expression is called a bridge. And what happens is that he gains a vagina and she grows a penis.
She takes his penis and he gets a vagina.
And he gets a vagina. Yes. So there's this sort of actual biological swap.
Right.
And so it's something that is portrayed in a way that's very important in the way it's portrayed, because you get the sense that this is something that's almost irreversible. It's extreme. It's something that you wouldn't do lightly.
Except that they do reverse it.
They do reverse it.
But it's unpleasant and definitely has consequences.
Yes. So you get this impression, as I said, that and in a way it's brilliantly done, because it's not, it kind of ups the ante on the concept of sex by making it, I don't want to say more meaningful, but maybe more dramatic,
mm-hmm,
or more consequence filled in a sense. So when he goes into it, he's still very much in his charismatic religious mode, where marriage is a commitment to one person forever and ever, amen. But he doesn't realize that the girl he's encountered is very much of a casual thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes through the experience, and then she's like, yeah, well, you know, I'm not gonna hang around. And he's like, what?
Yeah, he's like, wait, we're supposed to be soulmates.
Exactly. So then there's this, that they have to reverse it. And what I found interesting after that was that he doesn't have sex again after that first disappointment.
Yeah.
I found that fascinating because it almost seemed to parallel both the religious ecstasy and the sexual ecstasy as a trick or an accident of biology. Something to force you to feel committed to, or, and I was like, This is interesting.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if this was intended, but this is interesting.
No, his psychology of sex is so different than your average writer.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. In the book Permutation City, it has one of the most agonizingly unpleasant sex scenes ever. And I don't mean that it's awkwardly written. I mean that it's actually physically painful for the participants, even though it's normal sex, normal heterosexual sex.
Upping the ante again?
Yeah, pretty much. Almost. Basically, one guy, after fulfilling his obsessive quest, because we're so familiar with obsessive quests, he's uploaded his personality to a pocket universe. He has sex with this one woman, but his testicle, like, cramps up, and it's just agonizingly painful, and it's embarrassing for both of them, and after that, he kills himself, because his quest is done, and she gets to discover the body in the bathtub, and...
What?
Yeah. I'm not kidding.
Oh, good dear.
Yeah, so the flip side of that then is Schild's Ladder, which is one of the far future post-human stories. Mm-hmm. And in Schild's Ladder, gender is no longer relevant as a biological principle, because again, they're all post-human. But when two people get together, they grow genitalia that is compatible with each other. Okay. And it's different for every pairing. And you can be as promiscuous or not as your as you program your body to be, essentially. Mm-hmm. But it's unique to each pairing. But then there's one of my favorite scenes of all of Egan is in Schild's Ladder, where a post-human who's normally embodied agrees to help this post-human who is usually disembodied but has taken on a body kind of for fun mm-hmm. into this whole sex thing. Mm-hmm. And they start to grow the compatible genitalia, and the disembodied guy just like falls off the bed laughing rather than completing the act.
Okay. And of course, laughter and mockery are another aspect of sexual pain. Yes.
Right. Right. And I mean, it's a friendly encounter in that instance. Mm-hmm. They're friends. It's still okay afterwards. And literally the disembodied guy's like, "Oh, I'm really sorry. You know, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings." Uh-huh. But, you know, I do have to say that I think we've talked a little bit before about Egan queering gender. Gay and lesbian relationships are usually portrayed much more positively than heterosexual sex in Egan's fiction, which I've always found to be a kind of healthy, well, not kind of neat, I guess is the best way to put it.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Even in Orthogonal, there's a where the aliens have a biology that almost makes heterosexuality and homosexuality irrelevant. There's a relationship depicted that's clearly lesbian that's way more positive than the heterosexual norm in that culture.
Well, there's I'm hesitant only for one reason. Why? What's the underlying reason for there being more positive? Is it just accidental, or is it something like? Well, going back to Oceanic, there the problem was that he was expecting a level of commitment that she wasn't, and that level of commitment would have included, you know, family and children and being of the same religion and all that sort of thing. And sometimes when you look at especially the futuristic depictions of relationships, there's always this idea of where we may be committed, but there's a little more relaxation to it. So I'm just wondering whether it's not just that the heterosexual relationships are portrayed more negatively, but specifically the ones that rely on traditional structures of full commitment and traditional roles of spouse and so forth.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case, but I'd have to go back and look.
Okay.
It doesn't immediately jump out at me and go, "Why, yes, of course."
Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. Okay, because that would be interesting. And that, as I said, I'm wondering if Oceanic, the lesson in that was part of that as well, where you're almost, it's almost like he's being told that the sort of the thrill of the sexual attachment, which he wants then connect to deeper things in terms of the commitment and family and marriage and kids, was as unnecessary as his attaching the experience of this biochemical reaction to a deity.
Interesting. I never thought of it that way, but that's an interesting way of reading it.
I'm sorry, is this another footnote?
I'm gonna have to think about that one some more. But that's really cool.
Okay. Now, it is interesting, and again, because you've given me enough context on Egan, I'm not going to assume that this is actually his stance, because he flips things in other areas. But it would be interesting just to see if maybe by era or by particular community being depicted, whether there are certain trends or themes in that way.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's a way that I've looked at the fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, given the book's due in October, I won't get the chance before it's done, but that is definitely something to think about.
Oh, dear, I'm so bad.
It's out of the copy editor. I can't change everything now.
Okay, it's okay. But in a way, that's almost a question for another book entirely, because we've had a discussion, or touched on, I should say, I don't think it was a full discussion, the idea that even in the Heinlein era, you had science fiction authors who could be very experimental in how they were depicting aspects of relationships and gender and sexuality and so forth, but whose what they were writing is not necessarily what they were living or what they were believing, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah, fair enough, yeah.
So sometimes you have to look deeper in terms of how the relationships are being portrayed, not in terms of, okay, they have two women together, they have two men together, or, you know, two genderless people or what have you, but to see what sometimes what the power dynamics are,
mm-hmm.
what the commitment expectations are, and what the community expectations are, whether these are relationships that slot into a community or are considered very much individual business, the individual's business.
Right. Yeah, and Egan is mostly all about the individual and not about the community.
Interesting.
Yeah, and especially, like I say, I'm seeing it in Orthogonal now. In the Orthogonal Universe, which is his current trilogy, book two is out, I think, in September. I read it back in March. Oh, wait. Sorry. That was my outside voice. He grounds the science and the scientists in the community in a way that he hasn't in almost any of his previous novels. But it's still about a lot about individuals bucking society and changing it from the inside as opposed to... Sorry, say that again.
It's always about the rebel, then. It's always about the...
Yeah, still about the rebel.
Okay. That's interesting. And it's an approach that is... I don't want to call it common to science fiction, but in a way, both science fiction and to a certain extent, even fantasy, epic fantasy, does have this idea of the person who is the outsider or marginalized or gifted in a way that brings both power and fear, in a way, is the one who ends up being the protagonist. Or they see the world differently, so they're always in some way. And I do enjoy stories like that, but there is always a sociologist in me that wants to see stories about the individual who is rooted in society and plays the rules of society to their advantage. Because there are some interesting stories to be told in that respect.
Absolutely. And yeah, you're much less likely to see that in Egan.
Yeah.
Well, and you can kind of see why. I mean, the scientist, especially in you know, sort of dominant Western culture, is considered to be an outsider. They're eccentric, and they're boring, and they're dull, and they're geeky, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Why would you want to spend all your time, you know, playing with math? Well, even look at the way the science fiction community looks at Egan. I mean, he's notorious for his disdain of, well, not disdain, but his refusal to attend any kind of convention, whereas he points out, he's like, oh yeah, you guys say I'm a hermit, but, you know, I spend my weekends with my friends talking about math.
Do you know, your description could as easily be flipped to encompass the image of the hardcore literary professor.
Oh no, absolutely, you're right.
So it's probably not even just so much the subject as the the personality, I don't quite want to say the role as an artistic role, as an actor's role, but there's almost, I'm actually getting an image of Sherlock Holmes. There's almost this image of this person who is so incredibly brilliant in this one area that they just can't relate to anybody else.
Well, we do get back to the obsessive. I mean, I think it's fair to say that almost anybody who would devote the amount of time that Egan's devoted to his alternate cosmology for the Orthogonal trilogy is obsessive.
I mean, so there is a... Sorry, go ahead.
It would be possible to write that kind of hard SF without doing all that mathematical work. I don't think it's a coincidence that a lot of his protagonists are obsessive.
So now my question is, does this make Egan, in a certain way, even less accessible because his protagonists do tend to have a particular personality profile?
Some people have said that. Actually, was it Matt Chaney who made this point, or was it Martin, anyway, another critic pointed out that if Egan wants us to believe that all science is understandable by all people, then he should maybe make his protagonist a little more human so that the rest of us would believe that we could relate to that person. And of course, I actually kind of can relate to that person at least a little bit. So I'm like, hey, what do you mean that person's inhuman?
Yeah, so inhuman does seem a bit harsh.
Just like any fiction, though, how much you empathize with the character to an extent depends on where you're coming from.
Yeah,
because of my background, Egan has always lined up extremely well with my sympathies. I had the same negative experiences with deconstructionist philosophy in the 90s. I've had the same experiences with trying to integrate science and art. I've had the experience of being the kind of outsider geeky person. Of course, for scientists, I'm the outsider artsy person, so go figure. And I'm sure he's had that as well. And then he's addressed motherhood in his most recent trilogy, and motherhood in as it relates to being a scientist, at the same time I've become a mother. So, you know, I mean, it's just his career and his career as a writer and my career as both a scientist and a critic have resonated in just amazingly coincidental ways.
Cool.
But again, that's an extremely unique set of circumstances. And if some people say, hey, I just don't like Egan, I'm, you know, I can totally see that.
Well, I would say that my final verdict is Egan may not be to all tastes, but he's definitely worthwhile trying out.
Okay. That's good. I'm glad you don't feel that like this whole exercise was just a waste of time.
Listen, whenever I find these many things to discuss, it definitely hasn't been the same.
Good. Because I knew we had a hit with the Chang, but but like I say, Egan is not to all tastes, so.
And I think that if I'd been able to switch off my sociologist brain a bit more, I would have been able to be a bit kinder.
Right. Yeah, and he, I would say he's not a very sophisticated writer when it comes to that kind of social nuance.
And I must say, boundaries are so strongly drawn in his work, and I'm much more of a, you know, shades. Oh goodness, I didn't want to use that phrase anymore. I'm much more of a, not everything is black and white. It could be this, it could be that. There's nuance here. I'm much more of that kind of person. I would prefer a story where you don't tell me from the beginning who's the hero and who's the villain.
I do understand. Yeah. No, there's very rarely any question where Egan's sympathies lie.
Yes. So, and that does create some dissonance for me, because if I disagree with his reasons as to why the person is the hero, I do end up kind of going, okay, I'll just grit my teeth and go along for the ride.
Right.
but no, definitely worthwhile checking out, and it's one of those situations where you may not get the same delight as if you're reading an author who is more to your taste, but in terms of understanding the genre as a whole, and in terms of appreciating certain techniques of the writing craft, he's definitely worthwhile.
Excellent. Okay, so we should probably close the curtain then on our specific discussion of Egan.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And in our next episode, I believe we'll be discussing Mary Doria Russell's The Sparrow.
That's right. Okay. And we are, you will notice that we're not, in fact, flipping over to Caribbean SF again. Part of the fault lies with Egan, because we just ended up talking about more of his stuff for longer than we expected. But yes, it is time for us to have a look at The Sparrow. And then after The Sparrow, we will return to Caribbean SF when we look at Ghosts by Cardella Forbes.
Right, which I have my copy now, and I've already begun reading, so we should be in good shape for that.
Yes, beautiful.
Excellent. So I hope everyone will join us next week, and next episode.
Yes. It's tempting, isn't it?
Wonderful. Okay, great. So thank you everybody for listening, and we'll catch you next episode.
Bye.